This is March 4th, opening the Committee on Water for this day. And the first item of the agenda is public hearing on House Bill 2138. And before I, look at this, let me remind you that we've had a public hearing on this bill already. We have a limited amount of time that's been allocated for this, and for a number of you, we would appreciate it if there is a duplication of your testimony, either by yourselves or someone else representing you. So we'll move things along pretty quickly. We have first Wayne Greasy, Glenn Stonebrink, and Jim Paul. Would they all come up, please? Go ahead, Wayne.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Wayne Geesey. My address is Post Office Box 772, Paloma, Oregon. I served on the Native Fish Conservation Policy Task Force, and all of the members tried to do something that would give the ODF and W the prerogative to really make a program that would do some good for Oregon fisheries. Most of that was addressed to the Native Fish Conservation. However, as part of the package, they got into the hatchery program. And I would think that this bill would be well served if it waited until after the hatchery program was out so you could see exactly what they have developed before you put something in this. I would also recommend that you wait until NOAA puts out their program. And you also have perhaps a benefit, maybe you have it now, or maybe it'll be presented to you soon. Is there 10 scientists that are going to address this issue? And that's all I had to say. I don't know at this time that I would be against this proposal, but I'd like for these things to happen first. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Geesey?
Geesey is the way I pronounce it.
Okay.
But I've been called worse, Mr. Chairman.
Let's repeat. I think maybe.
Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, sir. Excuse me for that last quarter in the parking meter. For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink. I'm with the Oregon Paddlemen Association. Pardon me?
How long does that quarter last, Glenn?
Well, actually, it took a pocket full of quarters.
Oh, okay.
9 quarters will give you 3 hours. So I'm assuming it's 2138, the bill. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Very quickly, my only concern with this bill is on line 36, and the definition of recovery means that the population, instead of naturally produced fish, we would favor that being native fish. And native fish, of course, includes both hatchery and wild fish.
Question for Mr. Stonebrink?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Say again, which line?
On line 30, on line 16.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
Line 16. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And at this point, Mr. Paul apparently isn't here. Dennis Ritchie with the Oregon Anglers.
Excuse me, I got my accent in the wrong place.
Good morning, Chair Jensen, committee members. My name is Dennis Ritchie, 2311 Jolly Point Road in West Lynn. I'm executive director of Oregon Anglers. House Bill 2138 would accomplish what we feel is exactly the opposite of what it intends by ignoring the possibility of using genetically similar fish raised in protective custody of a hatchery setting. It makes counting of only wild fish an impediment to recovery. If those hatchery fish were to stray and spawn in the stream, their progeny would be considered wild and must be protected. However, if we take a wild fish into the hatchery setting and protect its progeny, that progeny can no longer be counted toward delisting. This doesn't make any sense, scientific or otherwise. I quote from a report by 10 independent fishery scientists, which would be attachment number one in your packet. There's no field evidence, applied studies, or demonstrated examples supporting allegations that hatchery fish do not reproduce successfully in the wild or that they decrease the fitness of wild populations. Most claims that hatchery fish are inferior are based on management mistakes over the past over 100 years of hatchery production, where stocks were genetically programmed for a particular set of environmental conditions and were transferred to a basin where they were doomed to failure. It's like saying the Willamette Valley is not a good agricultural production area because it does not grow bananas or breadfruit. Using wild brood stock from the same basin completely cancels out those problems. I'm including a white paper, which is the second attachment in that packet, on hatcheries by the Citizens Forum of the Columbia River Users. In this paper, we assert that the hatchery use is one of the key tools in salmon recovery, and to discount its use in any way dooms the recovery effort. We must find collaborative means of allowing salmon to recover without destroying our way of life and Oregon's economy. We have the scientific capability to accomplish this goal. The use of wild brood stock and counting that progeny may be the only way. Let's not let our laws get ahead of our science.
Questions for Mr. Ritchie?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ritchie. The chair would call Mr. Bowles from the Department of Fish and Wildlife to the stand, please. Good morning, Ed. And I realize that you probably don't come prepared with any written testimony this morning, since the chair is asking you to come up. There's been, a number of people concerned about the implied, at least their implied relegation of the hatchery fish to a second-class status. Is there, in your judgment and opinion, as you have helped work your way through this bill, any specific bias in here as far as hatchery fish are concerned?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Ed Bowles, the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And, Chair, you're correct, I didn't have any testimony prepared today. We provided comment at an earlier session. I do not believe there is any inherent anti-hatchery bias within this definition. What this definition does do is embrace the currency for recovery is naturally produced fish. That does not preclude hatcheries to be used as a recovery tool or a fishery production tool. And so those hatchery fish that are spawning in the wild, their immediate progeny would count towards recovery. And therefore, the hatchery tool, just like all other management tools, has no, this definition does not bias anything against that any more than it biases against harvest management or habitat management or any of those as a tool for recovery.
Mr. Bowles, it strikes me that listing of the species would never have would never have appeared if hatchery fish were considered in the same light as wild or native fish. Is that right? I mean, how could you ever list a species when you can just turn them out via the hatcheries?
My understanding of the Federal Endangered Species Act requires critters, plants, and animals to basically be able to complete their life cycle in their natural habitats. If you allowed, in this case, hatchery fish to be counted towards delisting directly, not as their progeny, but directly, that would also imply then that you could consider delisting endangered plants because they were grown in greenhouses or other animals in zoos. That has not been the intent of the law. I am not an attorney, so I can't speak to the legal requirements of the law, but that has been our interpretation of that.
And help me on one other point, if you would, please, Ed. If we take a hatchery fish and take, or not a hatchery fish, if we take a native or wild fish, as the term is used now, that returns and take the eggs from that wild fish and fertilize those eggs with the sperm of another wild fish that is returned, raise then the offspring in a hatchery, release them, and they go to sea, and they return. They're hatchery fish, but they go to sea and return, and spawn, and produce offspring. What's the status of that offspring?
Mr. Chair, they're wild fish.
So hatchery fish are taken, or wild fish are taken, the eggs are taken from them, we produce them in a hatchery, they go to sea and return and spawn naturally, and their offspring are considered the same wild fish as the one that are, whose parents originated as wild fish. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. And in addition to that, even if you didn't take originally wild broodstock and simply took hatchery adults returning and spawned them, and their those fish raised in a hatchery were allowed to spawn naturally, their progeny also would be considered wild fish.
Okay. Is there any other questions for Mr. Bowles? Thank you very much, Ed. The committee is going to stand at ease for 3 minutes. We will be back with you and at that time. Thank you. Hold on a second, I think. The House Water Committee will reconvene, and at this point we will open a work session on House Bill 2138. Does anyone have any questions, any comments, any concerns? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, as I recall from the last session from this committee that we asked this group to meet, and it seems to me what we heard was they met over a period of time. They constructed a very important document, and it seems to me that it would be appropriate for us to send this to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
That's basically correct, Representative Tomei. We passed out of the House last session a bill that created a task force to come up with a definition of recovery. One of the problems that we've had, and you've heard several people talk about wait for NOAA fisheries to do this. I have been waiting for NOAA fisheries to come up with a definition of recovery, or for that matter, I've been waiting for the federal EPA, which covers a lot of things other than fish in the Endangered Species Act, to come up with definitions of recovery for now, this is my fourth session in the legislature, and they're still in the process. Where in the process, I don't know, but I would guess about the same place they were 6 or 7 years ago. The intention of the bill that created the task force was for us to do something and hopefully to build at least a little bit of a fire under our federal partners to try to get them to act accordingly.
Great. Well, I would like to move the bill if you're prepared for that.
I would accept a motion.
I move that we send House Bill 2138 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei has moved House Bill 2138 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there other discussion? Representative Knoll.
Crump. Thank you for the honorable promotion.
Was that a Freudian slip on my
part? Perhaps. We're not going to talk psychology here.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, I will vote in the affirmative to move this bill to the floor. I am hopeful that there will be there's some additional work on the Senate side. I think this is very good work by a good group of people to try to get us to a place that, as you have well articulated, the federal government has been unwilling for whatever reasons to get to, and who knows when they will. And I think it's wise that Oregon gets ahead of that curve and demonstrates leadership, as we have in a lot of areas with the Oregon plan and so forth. I think that we can perhaps further define some of the issues that are in play here, probably on the Senate side, and I'm happy to move this bill forward because I think it's the right thing to do. So I will vote with the majority.
Thank you, Representative Knoll. Representative Flory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does not take a freshman long to pick up the fact that this has been long standing in process, and I appreciate your words that at least four sessions you've been working toward this end. Given the recommendation from Glenn Stone, Bring and Cattlemen's that naturally produced fish should be called native, given the testimony from Mr. Bowles that the fish indeed are the same as when in the off-going generations, and perhaps given the consideration that there can be either further bill introduced somewhere along the line or some refining as it goes through the process, I will vote to support this so that we can do something rather than let it languish yet another term.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Cruz.
We're discussing the bill, obviously. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have some concerns that, to a degree, this perpetuates a bias that has been in existence for a long time. I guess I would have some comfort, Mr. Chair, based on what Mr. Bowles just said on this bill. I would assume that he wouldn't have any problem with the next bill up, and if that next bill passed, then I think that would satisfy my concerns. But that remains to be seen. And clearly the science shows that hatchery fish raised in appropriate settings, and especially if it's a wild cross, should be allowed to reproduce naturally to enhance populations, and we have had a hard time getting there. I mean, you know, we do that, and then we pull them out before they have a chance to reproduce, and that's always bothered me. On the other hand, we have come a long way from where we were 6 years ago when you and I were first discussing this issue. And I don't want to impede the progress. I guess I don't want to slow this down necessarily. I think this would be good to put this in statute if indeed we also do a similar reference to hatchery fish, which is the next bill.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dingfelder. Any comments?
I don't have any comments. I was on the committee, and I was there for 18 months with you, and I think we worked out a lot of the issues that have been discussed here over the past few public hearings. So I'm going to be voting yes in support of this bill.
The chair doesn't have a lot of additional comments. I do think we have made some really significant strides with this bill. I think there have been some significant strides made in the thinking, not only in this body, but around the state, and perhaps even beyond this on this issue. When I first came here to talk about anything of a hatchery fish ever being anything like a quote unquote wild fish was heresy in some groups. It was in part and a major part the work of some of our friends, the Native Americans, and especially the group from my district, the Umatilla Indians, that have the tribe, the Umatilla tribe, that have taken hatchery fish and restored a run of salmon in the Umatilla River. Now, I say restored. The run was extinct for 70 years. And they took hatchery fish and brought them back. Now, since that time, the tribes, both in Washington and Oregon, have continued efforts in this line. So I think that was fuel for some of our fire to begin to talk about issues in a little different light than we had talked about them in the past. I'm hopeful that we can go beyond where we are now somewhere in the future, and I am sure that the science in this area will advance as we proceed, and I'm also sure that when that science advances, we will continue to have debate and argument about what is right and what is wrong. So with that, if there are no other comments, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Forrest?
Aye.
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Greenfelder?
Aye.
Representative Krupp?
Aye.
Chair Jensen?
Aye. Having seized the constitutional majority necessary, House Bill 2138 will be, I guess I shouldn't close that, will be sent to the floor, and the chair will carry the bill. This concludes the public or the work session on House Bill 2138. And at this point, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2459.
House Bill 2459 requires hatchery fish bred from wild stocks be considered wild fish and allowed to spawn, requires hatchery propagation to be from wild fish.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I could make a suggestion, I would suggest that you might open a public hearing on 2460, that it's a similar bill, only one's a referral.
Good suggestion. Thank you, Representative. And with that, we'll open the public hearing on 2460 along with the public hearing on 2459. The distinction between 2460 and 2459 is 2460 is a bill that is referred to the people for approval. 2459 is a direct up vote on that. So the folks coming to testify on this would, if you're scheduled on both bills, would please be advised that this is a one-shot testimony, okay, on both bills.
Same time.
We don't want to repeat in the same day your testimonies as much as we appreciate them. First off, we have Dale Blanchard to speak on the bill.
Chair Johnson, may I ask a question, please?
All right.
When we vote, will we vote separately?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good morning, Dale.
Representative Jensen, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Dale Blanchard. I live in West Lynn. I'm not representing any organization today, but I know that I'm not alone. I'm a licensed sport angler, a registered voter, and a lifelong resident of Oregon. 2 years ago, I spoke in opposition to the same bills, and I'm back again. I'm opposed to House Bills 2459 and 2460. I don't think they're necessary. I cannot guess what has motivated this proposal, but I'm quite certain it isn't a deep concern for the health of Oregon's fisheries. It seems very much like an attempt to build a loophole in the legal protection for endangered and threatened species. I don't believe it's appropriate for the legislature to dictate fisheries management policy to this degree. Policy at this level should be left to the Department of Fish and Wildlife and should be based on biological research rather than political concerns. Fisheries management in Oregon is a very, very complex undertaking. I consider myself fairly well informed on the topic of wild fish versus hatchery fish. I'm by no means an expert, by no means qualified to make fish management policy. Unless you have an advanced degree in biology and at least 10 years of practical experience in fisheries management, I don't consider you qualified either. I believe that this proposed statute would be detrimental to our threatened native fish populations. Hatchery production is not the solution to the wild fish crisis. An endangered species that depends on hatchery budgets is endangered indeed. We need to continue to work towards restoring and protecting habitat in order to enable genuine wild fish populations to become self-sustaining. The Department of Fish and Wildlife has a very difficult mission and is doing excellent work towards restoring wild fish while at the same time using hatcheries to provide harvest opportunities for commercial and recreational anglers. The native broodstock steelhead programs on the Wilson and Nestucca rivers are an example of how the agency is already fulfilling the intent of these bills without a legislative mandate. Good decisions about fisheries management need to be made watershed by watershed, even stream by stream, need to be flexible enough to accommodate changing environmental conditions. Dictating this statewide policy that would affect every species of fish raised in Oregon hatcheries is simply wrong. This is a very complicated issue. I know there are a wide variety of opinions. My opinion is that wild fish are not raised by humans in hatcheries, and that the survival and enhancement of naturally reproducing wild fish populations should be our highest priority for fisheries management. Please look at the big picture and ask yourself if improving the profit margin of one generation of humans is worth the extinction of animals that have lived in Oregon waters for thousands and thousands of years. Please don't spend any more of our time on this misguided idea. There's much more critical work for you to do. Thank you for this opportunity to participate, and I try to respond to any questions you might have.
Any questions? Just a brief question or observation. You say politicians are not not worthy or informed enough to make these decisions, would you recognize that if we made in this body the decision that you're proposing, that it's politicians who have made that decision?
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, I didn't say that politicians were not worthy to make the decision.
Qualified.
I think I said you weren't qualified. I think that, like I said, it needs to be made based on scientific fact rather than political concerns. The wording of this statute is just a little too broad for me. I mean, it affects every single fish in Oregon. Also, the logic involved that hatchery fish raised from wild stocks are wild, and hatchery fish are required to be bred from wild stocks. After one generation, every fish in Oregon is a wild fish, and I don't believe that. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the clarification on that. Catlin, if that's right, level. Good morning.
Good morning, Representative Jensen, honorable representatives. If it's okay with the committee, I would like to also have one of our members come up with me who's signed up to speak later on for both of these bills. I think
but
it would
course,
probably
please.
Be more efficient. Thank you. Tom Wolf.
Mr. Wolf. And please introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Caitlin Lovell. I am the Salmon Policy Coordinator for Trout Unlimited, located at 213 Southwest Ash Street, Suite 205, Portland, Oregon. By way of introduction, Trout Unlimited is the nation's largest cold water fisheries organization, with 127,000 members dedicated to the conservation of native wild cold water fisheries and the habitats that they depend on. Headquartered in Arlington, Virginia, our Western Conservation Office in Portland addresses salmon issues from Alaska to California. I myself have a Bachelor's of Science degree from a small university in Pennsylvania, where I spent 4 years doing primary research in aquatic ecology and 8 months studying marine fisheries and the effects of Atlantic salmon in Norway. From there, I went on to law school. It's kind of a disjunct. And now, thank you. I now serve as local counsel to Trout Unlimited and have spent the last 2 years doing nothing but evaluating and studying the impacts that hatcheries have from a legal, policy, and scientific perspective on wild fish. It was our organization that filed, along with 17 other organizations, including commercial fishermen and conservation organizations, the two petitions to list over 15 stocks of wild-only salmon and steelhead in the Columbia Basin of Oregon and Washington with the federal government. That it was, by the way, accepted for consideration because it presented substantial, and I quote, scientific and commercial information that warranted the proposed action. In this time that I've spent with Trout Unlimited, I've come to the conclusion that hatchery fish are not the same as wild salmon. I've had help reaching this conclusion from my counterpart in Alaska, where the use of hatcheries seems very contradictory to what we consider a healthy, wild, pristine habitat, to California, where we're working with the foremost coho geneticists in the world to actually develop a hatchery to bring back coho into the extirpated arid streams of Northern California. We've also consulted with the former head of the Bodega Bay Marine Labs, one of the foremost marine labs in the world, on this issue. So we're not opposed to the use of hatcheries. But all of those people and all of the scientists that we have consulted agree that hatchery fish and wild fish do have differences. And the reason is simple. We just can't do it. It's not to say that we shouldn't have hatcheries, but it is to say that we do not understand the complexities of the salmon biology to be able to replicate it. We do not have the biological background, we do not have the technical capability, and we certainly, in this day and age, do not have the financial wherewithal to walk down that road here today. I I had some more prepared statements, but I think what would be most helpful to the committee today would be to bring to you the story of Maine. It's a state that's dear and near to me as I grew up in New England. Maine was once home, Maine and the rest of New England actually, was once home to millions of Atlantic salmon. Millions. Today, there are 8 surviving populations. 8. The reason is very simple. There were over hundreds of thousands of fish produced from salmon farms and hatcheries. There was overfishing that masked the decline of wild salmon. And nowadays, salmon fishermen have to go all the way to the coast of Greenland to catch salmon because the salmon farms on the coast simply do not need the fishermen to help them produce the salmon. Appalled at this situation and concerned that the hatchery fish were in fact the same as Atlantic salmon, the governor of Maine called upon the National Science Foundation to investigate whether or not there were salmon from Maine or there were in fact Maine salmon. And you know what their conclusion was? There are in fact 8 surviving populations of Maine salmon. They are listed as endangered today, and they cannot in any way be recovered by the use of salmon farms because they simply do not have the populations to bring back those fish. The only thing that we can do for those fish today is protect what we have left and open up the habitat that they once had so that they can reproduce naturally. We could use hatcheries. We could use hatcheries if we had a robust enough population to bring them back. We don't. And we're headed down that path here in Oregon. We don't want to see the commercial fishermen, the sports fishermen. We do not want to see all of the wonderful conservationists who enjoy having salmon in their streams suffer that same fate. To address hatchery and salmon policy within Oregon, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife convened what they considered the Native Fish Conservation Task Force. This diverse group, including myself and Tom Wolf, was informed by scientists and federal agency representatives. We met for months. Months. I put in, personally, well over 100 hours into this effort, in a good faith effort to work out a solution outside of this very busy and very preoccupied legislature. The solution, known as the Native Fish Conservation Policy, was adopted and represented a compromise by all sides, but by far the supermajority of participants supported the NFCP, which distinguishes between hatchery and wild fish, but accommodates for both within Oregon's fisheries management and recovery and ESA management. This policy was looked upon favorably by the federal government. It was looked upon favorably by the scientists sitting around the table, and as I mentioned, a supermajority of the folks who participated in that task force. To undermine the NFCP with either House Bill 2459 or House Bill 2460 amounts to essentially an insult to the members of the task force and their hard work they invested in this final policy. But more to the point, today's efforts to pass these bills will leave Oregon and its people with nothing to gain and everything to lose. Representative Jensen, you had asked Ed Bowles earlier what the federal government's policies were in terms of the ESA and whether or not if we had hatchery fish, if we counted hatchery fish from the beginning, we would even have listings today. I would argue that, in fact, we would. The ESA, and there has not been a single judge that has ruled otherwise, and the federal government has not taken a stance otherwise. It applies to animals reproducing in their natural habitats. We look, when we evaluate the risk and the recovery of these species, we will always look to wild fish, regardless of whether or not we include hatchery fish in those populations. The federal law would not allow us to do otherwise. If these bills passed, then, the state of Oregon's laws would be inconsistent with the federal laws, and the federal laws would supersede. The state would lose credibility in multiple forums, including the federal government's ongoing reviews of the species within the ESA, and also the state risks losing their scientific credibility in the multiple forums that they're currently involved in. The veracity of these conclusions is evident, again, by the support of the federal government for this NFCP. This is not an issue for the state legislature or the voters to be attempting to resolve. It is a highly complex, multi-state, multi-jurisdictional issue that is currently and appropriately left to the experts within the agencies. They have received voluminous, and I really emphasize the luminous input from the various interest groups and have arrived at an educated and scientifically supported conclusion. On behalf of Trout Unlimited, I urge you not to recommend either of these bills for a vote. Thank you.
Tom, did you have other comments?
Yes, I have some written comments that I've turned into you.
Yes.
And
I'm going to ask everybody to try to keep their testimony to 5 minutes on this bill because there are a number of people signed up for. But we'll reserve questions, colleagues, until both people have had an opportunity. Thanks, Tom.
For the record, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the Oregon Council Chair of Trout Unlimited. I'm the head Trout Unlimited volunteer in the state. And I've also turned in some testimony written by Les Helgeson of the Native Fish Society. He is unable to be here today because of recovery from back surgery. I'll make my comments brief, and there are 3 points that I want to make. Number one is I'm not here to add anything to what Caitlin said as far as evidence that shows that there is a difference between wild and hatchery fish. There is tons and tons of data out there by many colleges, the American Fishery Society, and many groups that show that there is a difference. What I am here to argue is that many groups say that wild and hatchery fish are the same, and that is a hypothesis. And if you look at Webster's hypothesis, is defined as a proposition tentatively assumed in order to draw out its logical or empirical consequences and so test its accord with facts that are known or may be determined. In other words, it's an assumption that must be proved or disproved by comparison with observed facts. Right now, the whatever people say about hatchery or wild is it's an assumption, and it's an assumption that hasn't been proved. There may be some early results that are encouraging, but assumptions and hypotheses must be tested over a long period of time, as any scientist or medical researcher will tell you. So to pass a bill or to create a law based on assumption is would be the wrong thing to do. Secondly, as Caitlin stated, the state agency ODFW convened a Native Fish Conservation Policy Task Force with input from every stakeholder group that could be imagined, whether it be agriculture, forestry, property rights, and after many hours of discussion, and Caitlin probably underestimates the amount of time she spent on that and I spent on that, we came up with a reasonable policy. It's not perfect, but it's a policy that everybody to accept. And you've asked ODFW as the agency to define wild and hatchery fish to do this. They've done a good job. They are the professionals, as other people stated, and they should be allowed to be the professionals. And both these bills would undermine their authority and undermine the ability they have to recover native fish in the state. Thirdly, passing these bills would send the wrong message to the people of the state. It would send a message that the politicians here in Salem are more interested in political agendas than they are in creating bills that are factual and allowing the agencies to do their work. And recovery of salmon is not just about having fish in the stream. It's about healthy habitat. It's about good water and good water quality and quantity. So it's not just a one thing fits all. We've used hatchery fish in this state for 130 years, and we're still having problems. So in my mind, that shows that hatcheries by themselves don't work. I mean, let's be honest about this. Let's not create a bill that is based on assumption. So, in conclusion, I just want to say, I ask that you not pass on both these bills because they are erroneous. They are based on assumption, and they will not fix the problem. That's in conclusion, and thank you for this time. If you have any questions, feel free to ask.
Questions? Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, you say hatcheries don't work. Do you recognize that the tribes have had considerable success in the use of hatcheries to restore some of their runs?
Well, I would, to be honest, there's a article in the American Fisheries Society magazine in January of 2003 that shows that that there's an incredible high rate of stray fish coming out of that hatchery. I think the number is like 25 to 30%, which is way over what. So right now the evidence shows that there's a lot of fish returning, but are there a lot of fish actually spawning? And so I think to assume that they're having success, you need to have long-term observation of that. You can have success 2 years after they come back, but will there be recovering fish 10 years? Will they be actually spawning in the streams? And I think that needs to be tested before you can assume that that program is a success.
And Mr. Chair, if I may follow up,
please.
Could the two of you please explain to me how California condors bred and released in captivity, black-footed ferrets, Canadian lynx, are any different than hatchery fish in regards to the concept that a species can be propagated in captivity and released in the wild and therefore can be successful in regenerating itself?
Okay, Mike. Representative Jensen, Representative Kropf, those populations are based on a different section of the Endangered Species Act. They are specifically under a captive brood program and released under protections. They have not and are not considered wild sustainable populations at this point. So I would beg to respectfully differ with Representative Kropf that those are, in fact, the same as hatcheries. Hatcheries are not captive food programs. They are not intended to, in most cases, bring back species from the brink of extinction, although there are certainly some programs that are attempting to do so. And they are not in any way, as they appropriately should not be, considered wild, self-sustaining populations.
Well, Mr. Chair, I fail to see, in response to your answer, I fail to see how a different section of the Endangered Species Act changes the ultimate outcome that species can be propagated in the wild and propagated in captivity and released in the wild and has been successful clearly in those species then naturally reproducing themselves. I guess I don't understand the context of your answer.
Representative Jensen, if I may respond, please.
Please.
Representative Kropf, they're given different legal treatment. The section under the ESA is appropriately referred to as Section 10 of the ESA that allows for artificial production, like captive brood programs, to be used in recovery efforts. Those are under extremely rigorous, and I cannot emphasize that enough, extremely rigorous breeding guidelines that do not occur in hatcheries. But nonetheless, they are still treated very similarly in that the outcome of those captive brood populations are not considered wild populations. The black-footed ferrets populations, for example, that are currently existing in the wild are considered experimental populations and have a completely different set of rules under the Endangered Species Act. I don't know that that puts it into context for you, and it might just be that I'm not quite understanding the question, and I apologize if that's the case.
Well, I think my point, Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, although we'll have to move on because we have a long list of...
My point, frankly, is that the ultimate goal, whether we are arguing about definitive terms in legal terms in the Endangered Species Act, the ultimate goal is that we reproduce endangered or threatened populations of species in the wild to that the point that we can get to the point of recovery and remove them and they'll be healthy. And I fail to see how it's hard to argue with success. And I think in some extent that you are. And I think that that's unfortunate. And Tom, I'll make this last comment. In the end of your testimony here on the first page, you talk about political reasons and politicians. I might remind you that the Endangered Species Act was first written by politicians, and the fact that they are unable to extend it or reauthorize it in any different form than it currently exists is for political reasons. So this is a very political issue. And the point that we as politicians don't have the expertise to, and I think another gentleman had said that, to really make these decisions, I guess, I would suggest that judges who rule on these issues from third-party lawsuits that enforce provisions or changes of the Endangered Species Act, and politicians who write and authorize, or bureaucrats who give us obtuse, difficult-to-understand, non-supportable criteria such as stream temperature criteria, are also not qualified because they're bureaucrats. So if we're going to make that argument, let's be fair about it and understand that very few people other than scientists who devoted their lives to studying these issues are really the qualified individuals. The reality is we still have to make policy decisions. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll end my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And
I have two quick questions, if I may,
please,
Mr.
If you would,
Chair. Caitlin, when you were talking about Atlantic salmon, it seemed that you were talking about fish farms and hatcheries in the same context. Did you mean to do that, or did I misunderstand you?
Representative Jensen, Representative Tomei, I was talking about them in the same context of fisheries management there. So, yes, but I do realize that they are, in fact, separate, and fish farms have in no way ever been promoted to recover endangered species.
Great, thank you. And were you a part of the Salmon Recovery Task Force?
Representative Jensen, Representative Tomei, are you referring to the Umatilla Working Group? Oh, the salmon, right. I did attend the one day-long scientific session that was attended. Actually, I was fortunate to be in the same group as Representative Dingfelder.
I have one more quick question, if I may. Do you agree with the conclusion that they made, which the hatchery fish that spawn naturally, their offspring are wild fish?
Representative Tomei, Representative Jensen, we agree with that conclusion for management purposes, but we do not fully agree with the fact that the science indicates as such.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I just have a comment. There's no response. I think needed. The horse has probably been ridden as far as we want to ride him today. In relationship to politicians versus et al., we would understand that the Endangered Species Act was a product of politicians, without which we wouldn't be having this discussion today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mary Buchanan?
Buckman.
I'm sorry.
I should write a list there.
No, I should take a little better look at the list that's in front of me. It's very clear. My error. Excuse me.
Chair Jensen, committee members, my name is Mary Buckman, and I'm here representing the Oregon chapter of the American Fisheries Society. The American Fisheries Society is a professional organization for fishery biologists. We represent a diverse spectrum of people from federal, state, and tribal agencies, colleges and universities, private employers, students, and retirees. Our mission is to improve the conservation and sustainability of Oregon fishery resources and their aquatic ecosystems for long-term public benefit. We are speaking in opposition to both House Bill 2459 and 2460. We believe that these two pieces of legislation just simply aren't necessary at this point. If we assume that our goal is to produce high, sustainable numbers of fish, the actions described in House Bill 2459 are but one of many tools available to recover our fishery numbers. These tools will be specific to basins, and they will also probably be specific to species. Additionally, since the last session here, as I'm sure you all remember, this was a contentious issue then, ODFW has developed a native fish conservation policy, which with a large amount of public input. The Oregon chapter was one of the panel members. Currently, they're also developing a hatchery management policy with a lot of public input. A critical part of both of these policies is that the result will be conservation plans or hatchery plans that are specific to each basin. And we believe that this is the appropriate venue to resolve these sorts of issues. The strategies that will be employed will be different depending on the river system, the species of interest, the existing wild stocks, the goals of hatchery programs, and other factors. Like I said earlier, the management strategy described in 2459 and 2460 is but one of many tools available. Additionally, with regard to 2460, referring this to a vote of the people, we believe it's critically important to involve the public in a meaningful way in fish management. But doing this through an election is not an appropriate venue. These are complex issues, as you have heard from the other testifiers, and an election campaign with 30-second sound bites is not the best way to involve the public. In the native fish conservation policy and the draft hatchery management policy, the public is expected to play an integral role in development of plans for their specific basins. These will be informed decisions from the people that know the most about the basins. As we stated earlier, one size does not fit all. Involving the public, especially those most directly impacted, will be important in identifying needs and options for fish management. With regard to 2460, we don't believe this result is achieved through a statewide election. So in summary, we're here speaking in opposition to both 2459 and 2460 on the grounds that at this point they're simply not necessary. We have other venues to resolve these complex issues. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mary. Any questions for Mary? Appreciate your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
At this point, a breather and an opportunity to hear the other side of the story. Page 2, Glenn Stonebridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Stonebrink. I'm with the Oregon Cattlemen Association. I'm not sure exactly what that meant, Mr. Chairman, but I'll take it.
You take it as a compliment, Doug.
I'll take any compliment. Members of the committee, I didn't say previously, but I also served on the Native Fish Task Force, and that was a battleground. A lot of those votes that we argued about, wild fish, hatchery fish, et cetera, were 50-50 votes. Your committee administrator, I know he's not here to testify, but he also sat on those committees with me and could verify that. What we have here are two bills that one says that these salmon shall be allowed to reproduce if they return to spawn. And, you know, that means what? That means don't club them to death on the way back. Let fishermen catch them. We really haven't talked about that. I think that's a good thing. We also are looking at something is a need and a want, and I talk about that quite a bit in context of cost of government, that the public wants fish. But what happened if all of the wild fish were to be declared extinct? We'd still have fish. What happened if all the fish were gone, wild fish and hatchery fish were gone? Would this be an absolute need of the public? And I'm not advocating that, but is that really a need? It isn't. So, because the public wants fish, then I can see, I can't understand why anyone would be afraid of allowing the public to vote on what they want. This is a public want. And so for the life of me, I could never see why this would be, anyone would argue that the public shouldn't be able to vote on this. I actually believe that the legislature the legislators, as representatives of the people, certainly are capable of making the people's wishes known and have every right to do this. The previous testimony, and several times I said we shouldn't be doing these things on assumption, and I'm glad they're strong supporters of good science, as later we'll see a bill that defines science, and I hope they come back and support that. So I support both of these bills. I would have kind of a question is what happens if both pass? I assume if the legislature passes this, but the governor were the first one, 2459, but the governor were to veto it, but allow the other one to go to the public. I'm not sure how that would all work, and maybe the maker of the bill could explain that. But I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Glenn. And I think it will probably be a decision of the committee as to which bill will pass out of the House Committee on Water, if that is in fact the route that we wind up taking. Let Representative Cruz correct me if that's not his.
No, and that's true. I mean, clearly I would prefer that we do this statutorily, but these bills, if you remember, Glenn, were drafted last session when we had a high level of certainty that they would not get a governor's signature. So,
thank you. Yes, and then at this point, Aubrey. Aubrey Russell with Oregon Trout.
Good morning, Aubrey. Good morning, Chair Jensen. Good morning, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Aubrey Russell. I'm with Oregon Trout. Oregon Trout is a fish conservation organization with over 1,000 dues-paying members in Oregon. Our mission is to protect wild fish and the habitats that they depend on. The value of wild fish as one of Oregon's natural resources has not only been recognized by our members, who are fishing guides, sportsmen, sellers of outdoor equipment, businessmen and women, etc., but the value of wild fish has also been recognized and supported by the research and policies of numerous scientific and policy-making bodies, and I've included, attached to this testimony, I've included a small sample of articles and notes in professional and popular publications indicating the broad support in scientific and popular opinion for the views that I will outline here. Very simply, the principles that are accepted as fundamental by both the scientific and popular press, and the principles which are undermined by the two bills which are before you for your consideration, those principles, again, widely accepted, are that, one, as I've written in my testimony in front of you, wild and hatchery fish are distinct and important in measurable ways. Two, wild fish are a valuable resource. And three, the production of hatchery fish frequently creates a threat to wild fish. It's this third point that gives rise to the state agencies, ODF&W's, policies managing hatchery fish and wild fish differently. In some watersheds where wild fish are no longer existing, ODF&W has relatively free rein to manage for hatchery production. Oregon Trout's position is that in those relatively few watersheds where there are wild fish, those wild fish remain a very valuable part of Oregon's natural resources and natural heritage. And it's appropriate that the state manage these two different populations separately, that they manage both of them for their value, and these two bills would tie the hands of ODF&W and prevent them from maintaining for us those valuable wild populations. Why are wild populations valuable? I want to just touch on this very briefly. It occurred to me only last week as I was speaking with one of you in preparation for this hearing, that there's an analogy in forestry that I just clarified with someone from OFIC at the back of the room. I went, just a very short story, I went about 2 years ago to buy a couple hundred trees, dug firs to plant on some property owned by my parents, and I was surprised when I went to the nursery and they showed me a map of the North Willamette Valley and Southwest Washington, and there were all sorts of different regions, and these regions indicated where different seed sources were taken from. And what I learned was that each of these different small geographic regions had different climates, rainfall, soil types, exposure, which gave rise to different seed sorts. And those seeds in forestry were recognized as being very valuable to producing a high-value crop in a specific region. Wild fish are much the same. The wild fish genetics that you hear spoken of quite frequently are, like the trees, adapted over millennia to be most productive in very specific sites. Where we have those wild fish existing in those sites, it is not in the public interest to put enormous hatchery populations on top of them. On the lower Columbia, in the case of the lower Columbia coho, which I know because Oregon trout petitioned a few years ago to list them under the Federal Endangered Species Act, I can tell you that there are there have been as few as 1,600 returning adults, I think from an historic population of roughly 600,000 or 700,000.
Yeah.
There are 16 million hatchery smolts released into the Columbia system annually. So we have 16 million hatchery smolts and a couple thousand wild returning adults. You can understand a little the sorts of competition and disease issues that might give rise to stresses on that wild population. I've quoted for you on the backside of my testimony excerpts from some of these scientific documents produced by the independent multidisciplinary science team, by the American Fishery Society, by the Northwest Power Planning Council's Independent Science Advisory Board. All these views, and I've attached some of the papers again with my testimony, all these views support the idea that hatchery fish are distinct from wild fish. Wild fish are a valuable resource, and the production of hatchery fish frequently creates a threat to wild fish, and that concludes my testimony. If you have any questions.
Thank you, Aubrey. Any questions?
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair.
Aubrey, thanks for highlighting some of your the research and footnote material in the back. I appreciate that. Just a quick question. What do you think of the ODF&W's proposal to take the Fall Creek hatchery and modify it to create kind of a naturally environmental hatchery where they could rear smolts in what is a mimic or a mirror of nature? Is that a concept that you think is worthy exploring?
Oregon Trout supports all efforts to manage hatcheries in a way that is sensitive to the needs of wild populations that they might impact. Producing hatchery fish, there are many factors that you'd need to consider when you locate a hatchery in relation to a wild population, but it's certainly our belief that it's best to create it's a very complicated story, but the one of conservation hatcheries is, as Chair Jensen described, that's a valuable and I think interesting effort which can only improve the management of those two separate populations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Aubrey. I have a question.
Oh, excuse me, Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Aubrey, a suggestion has been made that more hatchery fish be allowed to go upstream and spawn naturally. Do you have a response to that?
Again, when you consider if there's a wild population which is potentially impacted by the presence of the hatchery fish, what you have to consider is think of the seed source. Think of those trees which represent a valuable, distinct, geographically adapted population. If you have if you put on top of them a brood stock, which either comes from a different sort of seed source or which has been managed, because as is pointed out in some of the material I've given you, domestication selection can genetically alter hatchery populations in relatively few generations. That's one of the conclusions of the Northwest Power Planning Council. They've been called Frankenfish, I think, in some contexts. It's a concern, and ODFNW I know is working to minimize that. And the Fall Creek Hatchery, conservation hatcheries are part of the effort to minimize this sort of domestication. But that's a reality of producing hatchery fish. And when you produce those fish and you release them on top of wild populations, you have an interaction which has been shown scientifically and empirically to reduce the overall survival of the population. The analogy that I like to make is if you cloned me a million times and you sent me to Michael Jordan's house for dinner, one of my clones would likely survive. The genetic fitness of the single surviving clone of me would be less good than it was before. The NBA would not benefit from that sort of. I don't know if you follow the analogy, but
somewhat.
I'm having a little trouble.
I hope you're not talking about the Hanes briefs.
The term used is survivability, and it's not survivability from egg to smolt or smolt to adult or even first generation or second generation. What's important is the survivability over time, as some other people have testified, that the hatchery population, domesticated fish, might have a short-term success. The history of extirpation of species along, say, the lower Columbia coho is interesting to look at, because you see in streams that were close to hatcheries, the wild populations disappeared at a rate much greater than in streams that were farther from hatcheries. So why was that? Because of the straying, the hatchery populations, again, put a bunch of me there, and so the Michael Jordans, I don't survive, and then what happens? Well, the streams are no longer home to many naturally spawning fish at all. So, and that's why they're listed. If you go and look at the surveys of those lower Columbia tributaries and see what if they're coho there, well, they're not. I mean, they haven't. The wild populations are gone. The hatchery populations haven't recolonized to the extent that we would like, as was intended 100 years ago. The promise of hatcheries hasn't played out as was originally thought it would, and their efforts now to reform hatcheries is a good effort.
I think we've ridden this horse again as far as we want to ride him. So we'll thank you very much, Aubrey.
Thank you.
The chair would like to make one observation or comment as far as the right or ability of this body to send out a referral to people on this issue. We appreciate that many of the people who probably are saying that the people shouldn't be involved in a referral on this because they don't know enough, and 20-second sound bites are not adequate to inform them, would point out that I believe it was ballot measure 80 a number of years ago, where Baron Cougar hunting was brought forth, and we took away from the Department of Fish and Wildlife the ability to basically manage the populations of Baron Cougar by a vote of the people in the state. So at least we'd like to, you know, ask you to stay consistent with, if it's, what's the old one, sauce for the goose, it's sauce for the gander sort of thing, too. With that, if we could have, could Dennis and Phil come up together, please?
But I won't say anything.
And again, I apologize, gentlemen, but we are already over our time. And
it's my pleasure to sit with us now.
and we appreciate your testimony and don't want to short you, so please don't think we are. Please.
Dennis Ritchie, Oregon Anglers, 2311 Jolly Point Road in Westland. Basically, I had some written comments that I've thrown away since I've heard the previous testimonies on this bill. Basically, I've heard some hogwash that is very inaccurate. First of all, we started Oregon Anglers as a group to save sports fishing. We saw it going down the tube. We felt it was too economically important to the state of Oregon. And I was asked to serve as executive director for this group because not only do I have a bachelor's and a master's in science, have taught science, and have worked from Fiji and Costa Rica on biologically sensitive species to having obtained a grant here for working on the Sandy River with junior high students in the on the salmon species. Basically, what we hear is about the genetic factor. You have hatchery fish, you have wild fish. Well, hatchery fish aren't just hatchery fish. You have every type of mixture within the hatchery, and there are a lot of bad stocks that we've used over the years that have really screwed up the wild fish on their spawning grounds at times. They were inappropriately brought into areas, and they weren't biologically and genetically suited to the areas that we transported them to. But that's not what this bill is dealing with. This bill is dealing with the use of fish that have already genetically succeeded in that particular basin. That's what we're dealing with. And the information about how hatchery fish have as soon as they come into the hatchery, they're forever ruined, is hogwash. Genetically, there's absolutely no difference. That's why even the conservation groups now accept second-generation fish, hatchery fish, spawning in the wild as wild fish. If they could tell them apart, believe me, they'd be jumping up and down trying to get them out of the rivers. Now, this may be a little bit radical, but I'm going to say it anyhow because I'm kind of a radical guy at times. If we had salmon recovery, they'd have a heck of a time raising funds. The spotted owl has been already proved as a red herring. If we could genetically produce fish in the hatcheries that could go up and spawn in second generation, there would be no difference, because the only difference is that we have those fish for a small part of their life in protective custody. But if they're strong enough to go to the ocean, they're strong enough to survive the trip down, the trip back, and the life in the ocean, these are not weak fish. And if they're genetically the same as the fish that are already in that river basin, it seems almost ridiculous for us to be arguing about this point. Caitlin brought up the example of the Atlantic salmon. Well, I'd like to bring up an example much more close to home. when Oregon Anglers started, we met with Director Lindsey Ball, and we were talking about the impending native fish policy and what it would mean. And I said to Lindsey, I would hate to see some of the stocks that have been captive stocks, like the Sandy River coho. This is a stock that went up that little creek originally and spawned. They built the hatchery there. They captured that whole run and used them as their basis for that Sandy River coho hatchery. Lindsey said at the time, this is a weak stock. It's been in captivity too long. Then they did the genetic studies in the Sandy River. Well, now that stock is touted as the super stock for Oregon, super coho stock, and it will be the salvation of bringing fish back to those lower Columbia River tributaries that no longer have coho runs. This bill may be on the right track in some ways, but basically I'm against it, and the reason I'm against it is because we need to give the native fish conservation policy a chance to work, first of all. Secondly, there may not be, and Phil, I'm sure, will say the same thing, there may not be in some areas enough wild fish to stock a hatchery without depleting the wild run itself. And I represent the fishermen. We want fish to catch. And just in 1997, almost $3 billion in direct and indirect taxes to the state of Oregon was realized through sportsmen. Not just sports fishing, but sportsmen. $3 billion. And if you take, let's say, even half of that, $1.5 billion in sports fishing, a good hunk of that is salmon and steelhead income. And 1997 was a lousy year for fishing. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go with Phil before any questions.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Donovan. I am here on behalf of the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry and the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. And I need to get here earlier because a lot of folks have stolen my thunder. But what I would like to do is speak to what I think is an unintended consequence of this legislation. Converting, or the requirement to convert all hatcheries to wild brood stock has a very real threat of greatly curtailing the number of hatchery smolts that we can produce. Our hatchery facilities, put simply, are not big enough to handle that sort of level of diversity. And we have firsthand knowledge of this, having recently worked in the Sandy River Basin, where there was a decision that was made to convert to broodstock. In doing so, we took our winter steelhead production from about 160,000 smolts to 120,000, and that was just because of limitations on the raceways at the hatchery facilities. Personnel costs also bearing a factor there. Now, if you were to take this and apply it statewide, or to look at the Columbia River, where the federal mitigation hatcheries that are managed by the Department of Fish and Wildlife are producing millions of smolts, and then try to curtail those down to broodstock, we'd lose a lot of production. So that's a very strong self-interest that we have in coming forward today and opposing this legislation. We've had this conversation with Representative Cruz in the past, and so he's aware of our opposition. We've heard a lot of debate this morning about the merits of supplementation. The truth is that, frankly, neither side has it exactly nailed as of yet, and so that was the purpose of basically 2 years of being in the interim work group trying to craft a native fish conservation policy. We've done so. We need to give it an opportunity to work. Both hatchery fish, wild fish, they both have great, tremendous value to the state of Oregon. And so while broodstock is an important tool, it's only one tool, and it's probably not the magic arrow that makes all of our problems go away. We need to have a full toolbox. Now, I do want to quickly comment on Representative Krupp's question. We strongly support getting that Fall Creek facility that's currently mothballed and having that turned into a research facility. We're the only state on the West Coast that doesn't have a research facility that's asking these tough questions. So what we're getting is, you know, studies from Maine and Minnesota, and we're not talking about our own things that are taking place right in our own backyard. yard. We should do that. And at the same time, we can take a facility right now that's being neglected, that is not being utilized, and put it to good use. It would be of tremendous value to people of the Mid-Coast. There's no question about that. Hatchery fish are strong for the economic economies of our rural Oregon. So anyways, with that, I will close and appreciate the time of the chair and this committee.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony. And at this point, batting cleanup, Ed Bowles with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And Ed, might I say, ask you to be brief. It would be the chair's intention, if we go to work session on this bill, to bring you back to testify at that time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Ed Bowles, Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I have written testimony provided to you that's a brief two-page testimony along with attachment of our native fish conservation policy adopted in rule in November. And the membership list for the Native Fish Conservation Policy Task Force that was referenced several times. Based on the chair's request, I'll keep this very brief. After listening to the testimony that we've heard, I wanted to just first mention that I think one of the important things that the Native Fish Conservation Policy is moving us towards is to move us away from this divisive debate on good fish, bad fish. Both hatchery fish and wild fish are important from a scientific standpoint, from a societal standpoint, for the citizens of the Oregon and for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The key is to use our best efforts, our public input, and our scientific information and our management needs to get the right tool for the right job, and to allow the flexibility to custom tailor these tools to fit the local watershed needs, both for the species and the communities in those watersheds. The native fish conservation policy and the hatchery policy that we are currently under development of, it has that as a strong mandate to try to strive for. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is not supportive of these two bills simply because it does not allow for that flexibility to get the right tool in the right place to address the right needs for both fish management and societal needs for fisheries. And so that is basically why we're not supporting this. In certain areas, these bills may be exactly the right thing to do, but in other areas, they may not be. I would also just mention, as Phil Donovan also brought up, that requiring the use of wild fish for brood stocks could seriously undermine the ability of our hatcheries to produce fish for fishing, particularly many of our mitigation facilities where those hatcheries are there because the wild fish have been either foreclosed through hydropower development or severely curtailed. And these hatcheries are there to produce fish for fishing, and there are not the wild fish available. Secondarily, under the federal ESA, bringing those wild fish directly into these hatcheries could cause us permitting problems in getting approval to have fisheries to take those fish. So those are a couple things for you to consider when you're doing a work session on this. I think I'll close with just saying that we are definitely moving forward with the concept of moving towards locally adapted broodstocks, transitioning towards these wild-oriented broodstocks. It may not be necessary or the best choice in every case, and we'd just like to retain the management flexibility to ensure it is the best management option. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ed. Just briefly before questions, let me point out that there is no commitment being made to bring this bill to a work session. The issue is if we bring it to a work session. We need to work with the sponsor of the bill and with the committee to try to reach an understanding of where we want to go from this point forward. But with that, Representative Shoffman.
Thank you. Good morning. Right now, are you looking at doing things like this in certain areas on certain fish runs and certain hatcheries? Are you in the middle of doing it, or are you just looking at it? Do you plan on doing it? Do you think what you said it may be a thing to do? Just want to elaborate on that a little bit, please.
Chair Jensen and Representative Schaffler, we are doing this exact approach in several areas, particularly with respect to conservation hatcheries in Northeast Oregon, some of the tribal initiatives that we are management partners with, where we are taking the wild fish into the hatcheries, using the hatcheries as a kind of protective custody to give them a survival boost, and then putting them out with the sole purpose of them spawning naturally. And in those cases, in many of them, we are even precluding any fisheries from occurring unless we get more than enough fish back. The first priority is for natural spawning. And within the hatchery management policy currently under development, we distinguish between conservation hatchery and harvest hatcheries and the priorities for what to do with the adults that come back. And in both of those, there is the option within those priorities to allow fish to spawn naturally, along with other uses such as fisheries and broodstock for the hatchery.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2459 and House Bill 2460. We will have a public hearing on these bills on the 13th. Is that what you have?
Yeah.
On the 13th? We will have... no.
This one we're trying to have.
Okay. We're closing the public hearing on 2459, 2460. And we are opening the public hearing on 2513. Mr. Taft.
House Bill 2513 requires the State Department of Agriculture to review water quality management plan and rules 2 years after adoption of plan and rules to determine effectiveness of plan and to determine whether operational difficulties exist. Prohibits the department from imposing civil penalty for non-compliance before completion of the 2-year review.
Okay, and I have two people signed up for this, Chuck Craig and John McDonald. Would you both mind coming up at the same time? And we'll lead off with Chuck from the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And I see both people have signed up against, so we don't have to worry about having a confrontation at the
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Chuck Craig, Deputy Director for the Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chair, when I first noticed that the bill had been dropped, I conferred with the sponsor, and he told me that his intention really was to introduce it to have a relating clause available, so I was a little surprised that the bill was getting a hearing, and I just wanted to say on the record that it puts the department in the uncomfortable position of pointing out concerns of a bill sponsored by a person that's been a dear, dear friend of ours over the year. So with that having been said, let me just tick through half a dozen points or so very quickly.
Mr. Craig, let me, Representative Cruz, I think, is not here at this time in the committee. He had an important meeting he had to go to. But having served with Representative Cruz through three sessions, five special sessions, and the beginning of this session, I'm sure that Representative Cruz is not so inclined to take any offense at your comments, because I think he already knows them. And,
Understood, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, first point is that we're already doing what the bill calls for in the 10 years since Senate Bill 1010 was passed. We have not found it necessary to assess a civil penalty against any landowners up to this point. And secondly, we have been and do review every water quality management plan every 2 years, not just during the first 2 years, and we do that by administrative rule. one of the great concerns that I have about this bill is that it would eliminate our ability to deal with egregious violations or what you might call bad actors during the so-called startup period of the water quality plan, and that's a tool we have to have. The next point is that 34 of the 39 water quality plans will be adopted when the bill goes into effect. If you look at the clause that says when the bill goes into law, they'll almost all already be adopted, and so there will only be five plans left for it to have an effect on. One of the more immediately serious issues is that the bill tends to complicate in a negative way our ongoing negotiations with EPA over EPA approval of the state's CAFO program. And the reason that it does is that we have proposed that the livestock operations that are in the smallest tier of the three-tier federal system of CAFOs actually be relegated to the 1010 process for addressing water quality concerns rather than remaining in a much more rigid and enforcement-oriented process under the CAFO program. And I checked with EPA just yesterday about this to confirm that this was an issue with them. They are uncomfortable with that. And we're going to have to prove to them that that's the thing to do. And so I'm almost certain that if this bill were to pass, they would say, no way will we buy into that. So, and then, Mr. Chair, the final issue is that there is a flaw in the bill legally that, if you recall, in the last session, the major piece of legislation affecting Senate Bill 1010 was Senate Bill 208, that was supported by a broad coalition of interest. That bill clarified that it is only the administrative rules that are enforceable in connection with the water quality management plan. The bill refers to the plan, to a violation of the plan, and so it actually, in its present form, it would not have any effect. So, Mr. Chair, those are the comments that I was prepared to make.
Thank you, Chuck. Any questions for Craig?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Yes, that's Grant Engvelder. I got it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck, I have a question for you. And I realize that the language in here is, as you just pointed out, is incorrect because you said it's the rules that actually are enforceable, not the plan itself. But can you tell me how many violations you've currently issued since the inception of the SB 1010 plans?
I can, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I can do that. Starting in 1998, the Tualatin plan was adopted in 95. So there's 3 years of history that are not here. But since 1998, there were 51 complaints that were investigated. There were 15 water quality advisories issued, which are this is the first loop during the early phase of plan implementation where we try to resolve things with landowners without going to enforcement action. So there were 15 of those. Only three of those was it necessary to proceed to formal enforcement action in which we issued three notices of noncompliance, which is the formal notice that says that if you don't do something, we're going to proceed with civil penalty action. And none of those three situations necessitated a civil penalty being assessed.
Follow-up, sir?
Follow-up.
Thank you. So in 4 years since the inception of this program, we've actually only seen three, as you said, non-compliance notices sent out. So would you conclude that this is sort of an unnecessary part or proposal in respect to this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, yes, I'm puzzled by what we need the bill for, to be frank.
Thank you.
Could I perhaps comment, Chuck, that this bill gave you an excellent opportunity to testify to the success of this and the commitment of Oregon farmers to, in fact, clean up the waters of our state. So without the bill, you might not have had the opportunity to testify on this committee.
Good point, Mr. Chair.
Mr. McDonald. Representative Jensen and members of the committee. My name is John McDonald. I'm the director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts, a district director in the now called Tualatin Soil and Water Conservation District in Washington County. And I'm also a farmer who happens to reside not too far away from one of the bad actors that Mr. Craig referred to earlier. Just want to make some comments, some of which will be repeating what Mr. Craig has said, but I'm looking at it from the point of view of the Soil and Water Conservation District that is not a regulatory agency. We are not in the enforcement business. We are in the business of working with landowners to address the problems that have been identified, some of which by the rules that were put in the plans. Let me take the two issues. One is to change from the rule to a statute requiring the review every 2 years is unnecessary since it's already the rule. In fact, the original was to do it every 3 years. So our plan that was the first one adopted was reviewed every 3 years, and we voluntarily moved it to 2 years. I think it's also important to remember that a review is not just pulling a set of rules and administrative rules and a plan off of the shelf and saying, okay, we're going to read it over, and if nobody has any questions, we'll stamp it and we go another 2 years. It is actually a process that involves an assessment again of what the driving forces are, such as the TMDLs, the water quality standards we're trying to address, whether the rules and prohibited conditions effectively, you know, have a process to deal with those. It is public meetings. It's going back to the advisory committees. It's soliciting technical assistance and advice from expert testimony. It's a reassessment of the plan objectives and the progress that's been made and so forth. So it is not just a, you know, quick and dirty thing we can do, you know, in a couple hours in one afternoon. It is a process that, if you enter into new TMDLs, actually gets to a revision of the plans and so forth. And the one we're currently undergoing, which is our third review and update, has taken about 6 months to deal with the new issues in a whole reformulation of rules and an update of the plan. So we don't particularly want to have to do that every 2 years, because sometimes we're a little leery about the availability of the ODA staff and so forth to be able to put in all the time and effort they have to, since the rules are obviously promulgated by the department, not by us as districts. And that might put a time squeeze if we're having to do 39 of these every 2 years with the amount of time that to do it correctly would entail. So we'd like the flexibility to be able to maybe, by rule change, go back to 3 years if we get into a crunch. Also, informal rules are going on every single year, because when the SWCD has to turn in its annual work plan to ODA annually, obviously, we have to say what we're doing about the implementation of the SB 1010 portion of our work. So we're taking a look at it at least annually, and they're also reviewing those plans. So there's informal process. To look at the second half about the two-year grace period for landowners after the adoption of a plan, again, we've been doing this for 6 years. We were the first plan adopted in the Tualatin. One of those non-compliance orders happened to come to a landowner. The process is going well. Conservation plans are being written, and we actually have monitoring data that shows that the water coming off the farming land is improving. We're making progress. We're actually being able to say we are doing some good. and it's partly responsible for this. No civil penalties, as Chuck said. Our concern is that we don't want to lose the leverage that the rules and the potential enforcement process gives us. Let's face it, the people with a good conservation ethic are not the problem. We're going to go out and talk to them. We're going to say, hey, here's the situation. Here's what we need to do. We're going to help you write a plan. Maybe we can get you some technical assistance and some financial assistance through farm bill monies or small grant monies and stuff like that to help you out. And come on, let's go do this. And 99% of the time they say, good, okay, fine. You know, I might as well do it now. It's those people who want to push it as far as they can push it, delay as far as they can delay, you know, do all the other stuff. And if you get into the progressive process Chuck was describing, from the adoption of the plan to the time you really get down to enforcement action, that's about 3 years. So the ones that are doing the worst practices have the least motivation and are going to just stall as far as they can in spite of, in one case that we had in the 12th, and 7 visits from us trying to motivate cooperation. We need that leverage that says, hey, it's sitting around there. Here's a defined issue. We're offering assistance. You're not going to be penalized. Let's do what needs to be done. Let's get on with it. You know, you're going to be better off in the long run. You know, everybody else is going to be better off in the long run. The water quality is going to improve. Why not do it now? We don't want that period sitting out there where our hands are tied. And frankly, in the case in the Tualatin, the guy pushed it to the limit. Absolutely pushed it to the limit, and it was a horrible mess. We were getting comments from Clean Water Services directors and so forth saying, when are you ag people going to get out there and do your job in the farming community? We're doing it in the city. You know, it needed to be done, and we need the leverage to, shall we say, motivate some cooperation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Donald, any questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just make the comment that it would distress me greatly to have any policy of this type that we would move forward that would create the issues that Deputy Director Craig has talked about in regards to CAFO. You know, you and I fought that battle with the EPA, along with the department and DEQ, to come to some agreement with them and the cattlemen last session, and I would hate to undo all of that work. I think we finally reached a good direction with them, and I wouldn't want to do anything that would move in that direction.
The chair concurs, Representative. I'd just like to make a concluding comment with this, as I recall, again, the 10-10 plan issue has been around this building now for several sessions. There was considerable consternation over it when it first came out, and I might add some considerable opposition in some areas to it. But the bottom line is that the plan 10-10 moved forward, and what I'm hearing today from the department, and at least from one district, that it's been pretty successful. And I think it makes a very strong statement. Since it is mostly voluntary, you can get down to a point of leverage if you wish, but most of the work that's taken place has been voluntary. And I think that's a very strong statement or endorsement of Oregon agriculture and Oregon farmers and their commitment to a clean environment that we have. So it seems to me, as someone who represents, admittedly, a rural district, but it seems to me the farmers have been frequently the ones who are criticized for all of the problems, that is not to say that some of the practices they've had in the past were not incorrect, but they have been generally very good about moving forward, I think. And, so, any other...
Representative Jensen, may I make just one 30-second comment? I actually celebrated the somewhat turmoil and upheaval and so forth, the process of the public responding to it and in certain locales and stuff like that. Because over the last couple of years, the experience has been that that kind of level of intensity that was being shown turned out to be that when they finally got it all out on the table, finally got through all that discussions and hashings and so forth, they arrived at a plan that they had a whole lot more ownership in than they ever would have without it. Mm-hmm. So maybe it actually ended up being a good thing.
Thank you. And I think I really appreciate that comment. I think it was part of the intention, if we go to the other area of the Oregon plan, was to get ownership by the people. Because if you get ownership by the people of the issue, you can move forward. If you don't have, it gets to be very difficult and good. With that, we are adjourned, colleagues, and my apologies for 2 minutes late.